Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, the postulator for the cause of canonization of Mary MacKillop, Sister Maria Casey, sets the record straight, shining the spotlight on the figure of God's doorkeeper, Canadian brother André Bessette, and stepping back in time, a sound portrait of Athanasius, Bishop of Alexandria. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. Blessed Mary MacKillop is currently being dubbed by the Western media as the patron saint of whistleblowers. On the eve of her canonization, I thought I'd set the record straight by speaking to the postulator for the cause of her canonization. She's Josephite, Sister Maria Casey. Sister Maria Casey, you're the postulator for the cause of canonization of Mary MacKillop, Mother Mary MacKillop, co-founder of the Sisters of St. Joseph of the Sacred Heart. Now, Mother Mary MacKillop, who once denounced clerical sexual abuse, is now being dubbed in the media as patron saint of whistleblowers at a time when the Catholic Church has been battered by criticism over the way it dealt or failed to deal with the recent clerical sexual abuse crisis. By doing this, isn't there the risk of reducing her reputation to this particular area?
Well, first of all, to set the record straight, she herself did not denounce the priest. She was away in Queensland, 2,000 miles away, when the events were reported. It were her sisters who lived in the local convent in this place that reported the abuse to Father Woods, and in turn he'd reported it to the Vicar General. The Bishop of the day was here in Rome for the First Vatican Council, and so the Vicar General took action, as he was expected to do. He removed the priest immediately from the parish, and having consulted, sent him back to Ireland. So his best friend then was very, very angry with the events that unfolded, and he pledged, because he already had a problem with Father Woods, that he would destroy Father Woods and would also destroy the Josephite sisters. So indirectly it was a factor in the excommunication, but indirectly, because misinformation about other matters were then fed to the bishop to help him come to the decision to excommunicate Mary. So it was a very, very complex issue about the excommunication. It was a factor, but not a direct factor. Now, as to whether or not it is reductive, I agree it is reductive. Mary stood for the dignity of all people, regardless of their creed, their colour, or what else.
Which was unusual at the time.
It was very unusual.
We're talking the end of the 19th century.
Exactly. And she had this great respect for people, regardless of who they were. She would not have condoned oppression or violation of anyone's dignity, whether by sex abuse or whether by diminishment in terms of employment, in terms of racial discrimination or anywhere else. So from that point of view, I think saying that she's the patron of whistleblowers or those that are abused does not encompass the person that Mary was. I'm not saying that she wouldn't care about those. She would have been vitally interested, and was, and suffered enormous pain for anyone who suffered abuse of any kind. So she would have been feeling their pain, and she would have felt their loss of dignity and their loss of appreciation in the society. So she would have been very, very in tune with their hurt and their needs. But she is broader than that. So that, while that is part of who she was, she would be better to be the patroness, and I'm not sure how you would phrase it, of the dignity of all people.
Not just women.
Not just women. She was very concerned for the dignity of men and women and children, and especially children, because she felt that if children had the opportunity to be educated, they would grow up and they would have a chance of a better life. One of the Australian authors, a non-Catholic and an avowed atheist, said that Mary gave the ticket of leave to these children. In other words, she freed them from the slavery of not being anybody like the convicts were. And from being the convict or from being oppressed, they then had this ticket of leave, which gave them the freedom to live in society and better themselves.
You talk about the convicts. Not all our listeners know about the convicts in Australia.
Yes, many of the early Australians were convicts, and as I often say, chosen by the best judges in England to be sent to the colonies to help to populate the colonies, and often for minor misdemeanours. For instance, there are men there and women there whose big crime was that they stole a loaf of bread to feed their families. It was often the result of abject poverty, or they stole a sheep, or something else that was not, in today's society, very significant, certainly not deserving of banishment, sometimes for 7 years, sometimes for life. So from these convict origins, Australia grew. In later years, the free people came, free population came to live in Australia, but the early people were mostly convicts, and when they had served their sentence, they got what they called their ticket of leave.
She lived at a time when there was a huge problem with the Aborigines as well, no? And she was very helpful to them.
She was helpful to the Aborigines that were around and close to her uncle's property, and she, in her spare time, taught them to read and write. And a few years ago, I was at a function, and their descendants were all at it, and very, very proud of the connection with Mary. Her brother, who was a Jesuit priest, taught and worked and lived in a place called Daly River at the north of northwest Australia. And it was Mary's intention that sisters would go to that mission outpost to help him establish a school and to help him care and assist these Aboriginal people to achieve their own dignity. Something happened on each of the occasions that she had planned to go, and finally everything was organised and a monsoon came and washed everything away. The whole mission was destroyed. So that was the last time she was able to make the decision to go there. So it wasn't until the early 1960s that the sisters of St. Joseph, whom she founded, were able to go to the Aboriginal missions. So it was a long dream of Mary's that was fulfilled in that part of Australia. The sisters had worked with the Aboriginal people in New South Wales, Queensland and South Australia for many, many years. So right from the beginning, there was great involvement with the Aboriginal people.
So she was a woman for all people, wasn't she?
She was.
Her legacy today is not just for Catholics.
No, and it never was really, because even in the early days when she set up the schools in the isolated parishes, or there weren't even parishes, there were isolated villages, not even that either, she never discriminated against children regardless of their religion. So many of the early schools had non-Catholic children as well, which was most unusual.
Jewish children,
Presbyterian. I'm not so sure about how many Jewish, because there were very few Jews in those country areas in her time. But one of her best supporters, and after she was excommunicated, the person who gave her shelter for some time and then provided shelter for some of the other women, was a Jew, Mr. Solomon, who had been a convict and had finished his term, had gone to South Australia from New South Wales and became a Member of Parliament. He was a wonderful man to Mary.
So in a sense it's redundant to ask what her legacy is today. I mean, she was a very modern character for her time.
She was, and the sisters today, we now feel that education is being well catered for throughout Australia and New Zealand. So we work still with the people who have a loss of dignity, the boat people, the people who are illegal migrants, the people who come in as refugees, the Aboriginal people we still have a very big commitment to, women who are being trafficked, men who are being trafficked, the unemployed, those that need comfort in some way or another. So a lot of the sisters work in pastoral work, just visiting the people, being with them in times of sorrow. So Mary's legacy lives on. We also have sisters in Brazil and Peru and now also in Scotland and Ireland, sisters working in East Timor where the poverty is extreme, and they were forbidden to speak their own language, so the sisters have translated their and learnt their language and have printed for them the first time ever their own books in their own language.
So you have new vocations then?
We have some new vocations, but our biggest development is the number of lay people who are living by the spirit and the charism of Mary MacKillop. And we have many, many lay people who then will work with the sisters closely but remain as lay people. Well, the sisters are lay people too, but lay people with vows living in community. These lay people sometimes will work for a number of years with the sisters in a very close cooperation. Sometimes they will work from their own homes and from their own families, supporting the sisters in their mission and their ministry. So we have many, many of those. So it's, as it were, the laity coming into their own in this century, the great gifts that the lay people have to offer to the church and to the world, and that it is no longer the place just of religious, if I could dare say it, to do good works, because every human being is capable of doing good works.
And warm thanks there to Sister Maria Casey, and congratulations to her and to all of her order. Also among those to be canonised by Pope Benedict XVI on Sunday 17th of October is Canadian Brother André Bessette, one of the architects of the Catholic Church in Montreal. Popularly referred to as God's doorkeeper, he was a man who never gave up on his dreams as the rector of the Oratory of St. Joseph's in Montreal. Father Claude Grou, a religious of the Holy Cross, tells Bob White.
I think Brother André is a very interesting model for people of every times and especially of our days, because Brother André is a man who started with what many people have when they start with. He came from a relatively poor family, but then very quickly he realized that he had great gifts to bring to the people. He is a man who has been seen as a very generous man. What struck me is Brother André, as he became a religious of Holy Cross, he had a simple work as a doorkeeper and doing all kinds of little work in the college, but he was not satisfied with this work. He was always open to listen to people who came to him and start talking with people and pray with the people. And very quickly, people realized the power of this man, and people would be more and more attached to him. So this generosity of taking whatever means I have and make the best use of it for the service of the others and serving others to serve God and to help people to grow in their faith through this experience, I find that something very important.
Could you say something about the connection between his life, his vision, and perhaps even the initial concept building the Oratory of St. Joseph and the shrine there?
Yeah, let's very, very quickly begin with his birth in a small town near Montreal. Then, as a young man, he went to work in the northeast United States, as many young Canadians who were poor tried to find a living by living in the United States. In 1867, came back to Canada, and then discovered the vocation to religious life and joined the Brothers of Holy Cross as part of this congregation of priests and brothers. And he came to College Notre Dame, where he was asked to be doorkeeper, which meant doing all kinds of hard works also for the community. But Brother André had, from his family, probably a great devotion to Saint Joseph. And as a brother of Holy Cross, the patron of the brothers in the congregation is Saint Joseph, so probably this increased even his interest in developing his devotion to St. Joseph. Just in front of College Notre Dame, there was a small mount. But then on the side of this mount, there was a space, and Brother André dreamt that one day he could build a small place there where people could come with him and pray with him to St. Joseph. So in 1904, it was become possible for him to build a small place. He was still working at College Notre Dame, but his superiors allowed him to walk across, and if he would find the money and friends who could help him to build a small place. That's why it's called Oratory. Oratory normally is not a big sanctuary, just a small praying space. And that's what he built at the beginning, just a place for people to come and pray. And very quickly, people came by thousands to pray at the side of the mountain. So the place was not sufficient. So the help of other people and with the help of the community, he saw that it would be possible to build something a little bigger. And the place has grown from years to years till its completion in 1967 with the big basilica being completed.
From what you know of his life and being there, the director of the shrine, is there a particular virtue that you think he exhibited in his life that could have a continued significance for people trying to live as Christian disciples today?
Yes, I would put two words together. His capacity to listen to people and his generosity to put himself at the service of others. You know, when he would finish his day of work, very often somebody would come and say, somebody's sick in the hospital, would you be able to come? And he would always find ways to extend his energy and his days to be able to go out and help people. So, and I believe today we need people who can listen to the needs of others and respond to the needs of others. And in that way, Brother Andre, I think, is an important model for our days.
You were listening there to the rector of the Oratory of St. Joseph's in Montreal, Father Claude Grou, a religious of the Holy Cross, speaking to Bob White. Finally, looking east, we bring you a sound portrait of St. Athanasius, Doctor of the Church, Bishop of Alexandria for nearly half a century, and champion of Christian orthodoxy against Arianism, in a programme written by Jill Bevilacqua and produced by Sean Patrick Lovett.
As a young man, Athanasius was present at the Council of Nicaea, at which the Nicene Creed was formulated, ending with the inexorable words,
"As for those who say, there was a time when he did not exist. Before he was begotten, he did not exist. He was made from nothing, or from another substance or essence. The Son of God is a created being, changeable, capable of alteration. To such as these, the Catholic Church says, anathema."
Athanasius was born around the year 295, probably in Alexandria, at a time when the Egyptian Church was divided by schism. While still a boy, he was taken into the household of Bishop Alexander, who had early recognized his talents. And when the Emperor Constantine called the Council of Nicaea in 325, Athanasius, now a deacon, accompanied the bishop as private secretary. He was not a member of the council, but we are told that he spoke there, probably unofficially. His passionate defense of the deity of Christ on that occasion won him the eternal enmity of the Arians, who saw in Athanasius their most formidable antagonist.
In 328, he succeeded Alexander as bishop. He was already popular with the people, who cried out during his election, "Give us Athanasius the Good, one of the ascetics." For 7 years, he occupied his see, devoting himself to the work of the diocese and visiting the monks in the desert. Athanasius was a monk himself at heart and encouraged the monastic movement within the Egyptian desert. The first bishop to promote monasticism, he enabled the ascetic spirit to find a home in the Catholic Church and gave the first great thrust to monastic life. The monks rewarded him by supporting him in all his difficulties.
Athanasius wrote his first work, such as On the Incarnation of the Word, when he was still in his 20s. But although he was to go deeper and deeper in his thinking, he always retained a fear of approaching the great truths, as he wrote to the monks.
"I have hesitated to write on the highest and chief doctrines, lest what is imperfectly expressed through my inadequacy or the obscurity of language do hurt to the reader. For the more I desired to write and endeavored to force myself to understand the divinity of the word, so much the more did the knowledge thereof withdraw itself from me. And in proportion, as I thought that I apprehended it, so much I perceived myself to fail of doing so. Moreover, I was unable to express in writing even what I seemed to myself to understand. And what I wrote was unequal to the imperfect shadow of the truth which existed in my thoughts."
Now was beginning one of the stormiest eras in the whole history of the Church. The reaction against Nicaea had begun. Constantine tried to force unity by persecution, but Athanasius protested. When he refused to admit Arius to communion, a whole series of charges were brought against him, which he refuted in person to Constantine. But the opposition went on. Athanasius was deposed by a synod at Tyre. He decided on a bold step. He would appeal to the emperor in person.
He set off post-haste for the capital. When he arrived at the palace, he asked for an audience. But the Arians had bribed the palace guards and refused to let him in. Athanasius was not dismayed. He waited outside, and when the emperor came by, he stopped him in the middle of the road, requesting that those who had condemned him might be called to appear in front of Constantine, so that Athanasius could confound them in the emperor's presence. Constantine at first refused and ordered the removal of the bishop. But Athanasius insisted, till Constantine at last agreed to write to the bishops.
But the leaders of the synod immediately trumped up a new charge. They accused Athanasius of threatening to call a dock strike at Alexandria, stopping the vital corn supply to Constantinople if the emperor failed to support him, and of making his own profit out of imperial grants of corn to the poor. Constantine, furious, destituted Athanasius and sent him into exile. "The Lord will judge between you and me," the bishop responded calmly to his emperor before leaving for the desert. 2 years later, Constantine was dead.
Athanasius spent the greater part of his long life, and he lived to be nearly 80, battling against Arianism. But it was not until 5 years after his death that the heresy finally collapsed. Athanasius had recognized the danger to the church from the start. And as Carlyle wrote, if Arianism had triumphed, Christianity today would be but a legend.
This heresy has come forth upon the earth like some wild monster, which not only injures the innocent with its words, as with teeth, but has also hired external power to assist it. The truth is not preached with swords or darts, nor by means of soldiers, but by persuasion and counsel. But what persuasion is there when fear of the emperor prevails? Or what counsel is there when he who withstands them receives at last banishment and death?
After Constantine's death, Athanasius returned to his see, but his enemies forced him to flee once more, this time to Rome, where Pope Julius held a council of Western bishops which acquitted Athanasius. But though the Pope remonstrated with the Eastern bishops, the deposition of Athanasius was confirmed, and an Arian bishop named Gregory appointed in his place. Athanasius wrote an encyclical to all bishops everywhere.
And now this wonderful Gregory accuses before the governor those who pray in their own homes, and he takes every opportunity to insult their ministers. His conduct is of such violence, then, that many run the risk of not being baptized, and many have no one to visit them in sickness and distress, a circumstance which they regret even more bitterly than their illness. For while the ministers of the church are under persecution, the people condemn the impiety of the Arian heretics and choose rather to be sick and to run the risk than to permit a hand of the Arians to come upon their head.
Athanasius was a tough fighter, and he was soon back in his see. But the emperor Constantius, Arian son of Constantine, was determined to be rid of him and made yet another attempt to influence the Orthodox bishops against him. He summoned them and ordered them to subscribe against Athanasius and to hold communion with the heretics on pain of banishment. Athanasius himself describes their reaction.
When the bishops heard this, they were utterly amazed, and stretching forth their hands to God, they used great boldness of speech against him, teaching him that the kingdom was not his but God's, who had given it to him, whom also they bade him fear, lest he should suddenly take it away from him. And they threatened him with the day of judgment, and warned him against infringing ecclesiastical order and mingling Roman sovereignty with the constitution of the church, not to introduce the Arian heresy into the church of God.
Constantius condemned the bishops. Athanasius himself, after a night of vigil in his cathedral filled with worshippers, sent the people home and finally allowed his ministers to drag him out in the midst of the emperor's soldiers to yet another exile. He wrote an explanation for this flight, that to every man a time is allotted, and our Lord himself had set an example.
He neither suffered himself to be taken before the time came, nor did he hide himself when it was come. The persecutors sought after the saints that there might be no one to teach, as the Jews charged the apostles. But for this cause they endured all things that the gospel might be preached. They passed not the time of their flight unprofitably, nor, while they were persecuted, did they forget the welfare of others. When, while they fled, they preached the gospel, and gave warning of the wickedness of those who conspired against them, and confirmed the faithful by their exhortations.
After being restored and yet again deposed, Athanasius was recalled by the Emperor Julian after 6 years of exile. But Julian saw in Athanasius the foremost representative of the religion that he hated, and 8 months later, despite the protests of the people, he forced the bishop once again out to the desert.
It was Julian the Apostate who described Athanasius as this troublesome bit of a man. And Athanasius, small and energetic, managed to give trouble to quite a few people in his time. During his 40 years as bishop, he was 5 times driven into exile by heretics and politicians. But his enemies failed to shake his profound faith, and he never ceded 1 inch in his defense of orthodoxy. Athanasius against the world became a battle cry for many a kindred spirit in the centuries that followed.
The name of Athanasius is usually linked to the Athanasian Creed, a document of 40 rhythmic Latin clauses used as a confession of faith. But although numerous scholars attributed it to Athanasius, it has more recently been admitted to be much later in date. Athanasius of Egypt, called the Father of Orthodoxy, is recognized as one of the great Greek doctors of the Universal Church. Shrewd in argument and a brilliant biblical scholar, he was certainly one of the greatest characters in early church history. He's described by scholars as being in the first rank of the great religious reformers, because he recalled Christianity from the barren paths of speculation to a new sense of the reality of the gospel. He was the first of the great protagonists of spiritual liberty against the encroachments of the state.
His aim in life was the greatest welfare of the church. His supreme achievement was that by his unflinching constancy to the truth, combined with his willingness to tolerate a variety of expression, by his personal holiness and devotion, he saved Christianity from compromising its assertion of the two fundamental truths of the unity of God and the divinity of Christ. His great strength is that he was never the mere theologian. His interest is in the religion of the plain man, for he envisaged a wide and sometimes illiterate audience.
Athanasius, we're told, was at heart a monk, and nowhere is his love for the monastic life more evident than in his Life of Antony, described as a eulogy of the entire Egyptian anchoritic movement, and a plea for a return to the primitive ideals of the gospel. He wrote this introduction in his Life of Antony for the monks of the West.
I have acceded to your request with great promptness and willingness, for there is a great advantage for me merely to recall the memory of Antony. And I feel that when you have heard the story, you will be able to admire the man and to emulate his resolve. His is an ideal example for monks in the pursuit of asceticism.
You were listening there to a programme written by Jill Bevilacqua and produced by Sean Patrick Lovett. Our thanks go to both of them. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. You've been listening to the English programme of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.